I just realised I haven't given this talk a title. I always say to my students, if they don't know what the thing is called, it isn't finished yet. So maybe it's not finished. Maybe it's just notes for a talk. So we've been looking at the system of practice. We've looked at integration. We've looked at positive emotion. And in these stages, we're developing the capacities for awareness, attentional stability, responsiveness, and a certain degree of happy, healthy self. This is actually very good. It's a good end in itself. And many people come to the centre just to learn meditation in order to get themselves together and have a better life. And that is wonderful. That really is a good thing. But it's not the goal of Buddhism itself. I think it's just quite good just to mark that, you know. It's great that we all come and we're able to get our heads together and sort out our lives and get through the day. But I think none of us would be here if we didn't have a sense that there was something a bit more. And so it's that something a bit more. It's what the Buddha left home for. It's what he did the spiritual quest for. And the importance of these of integration and positive emotion is to get us to a point where we can actually work with the subsequent stages. We can start to deal with spiritual death, spiritual rebirth. At the end of the talk, there will be a test. multiple choice questions, just to see how much you have taken in. It's devised by Vasantra to test our knowledge about spiritual death, and the results will be published on the NLBC Facebook page tomorrow. I think that's the only joke I've got in here, actually. Yeah. So I should say that although I'm talking about these stages in the system of practice as if they were neatly packaged parcels of experience, actually they can occur non-sequentially, simultaneously, and seemingly randomly. What the system of practice tries to outline is a path of regular steps, which, if we can engage with it in that way, provides the basis for a sustainable practice. But it doesn't always work out like that. Sometimes things just happen. With spiritual death, it's particularly noticeable that... hang on, I've made so many edits on this I can't read my writing. Oh, there's also this sense that with the spiritual death and rebirth, that spiritual rebirth is already present implicitly and sometimes explicitly when we're dealing with spiritual death. So we already started this cycle in the winter solstice, and I think most of you are probably here for the winter solstice ritual that we had. So we had this thing where we filled the room with candles, we all had a candle, there was candles on the shrine, in the central shrine, turned all the lights off, and we blew all the candles out, and we sat in the dark. And then somebody lights one candle, and then we light them all off. So that sense of going into the dark, the dying of the year, and then symbolically enacting the rebirth of the year on the solstice. I wanted to bring in a quote from a paper that Subhuti wrote a year or so ago, a couple of years ago, and he's talking about the system of practice. The next stage, that of spiritual death, it focuses on seeing through our misunderstandings about the nature of reality itself, especially about who and what we ourselves are. Spiritual death means seeing through our habitual delusions, our automatic misreadings of our experience, seeing the impermanent as enduring, seeing the insubstantial as having essence, blindly believing that what in truth can only bring suffering if we cling to it is a real source of abiding happiness, and finding attractive and desirable what is from the highest perspective repellent. I'll just go through that list again. He's talking about the viparyasas, or the topsy-turvy views. It's seeing the impermanent as permanent. It's seeing the insubstantial as substantial. It's seeing what causes suffering as being something that could lead to our happiness, and it's seeing it's seeing what is repellent as actually beautiful. So it's kind of, it's mixed up. It's basically saying we're mixed up. It's quite a strong way of putting it, but anyway, he's brought that in here. But it's just the emphasis on views, the viraparyasas. These views prevent us from seeing the reality of our situation, that everything is, in fact, impermanent and insubstantial, and that true happiness cannot lie in any particular arrangement of conditioned phenomena. Yeah, I'll skip the next bit. Above all, spiritual death means dying, in the sense of loosening our illusions about ourselves and giving up our self-orientated clinging, recognizing that such clinging is psychologically counterproductive, ethically compromised, and most fundamentally, existentially deluded. This stage is primarily practiced through reflection on the true nature of reality, especially by considering the lakshanas, that's the marks of conditioned existence, and through selfless activity that breaks down the fixity of self-attachment. I think I might have to give a whole talk just to explain what he means there. But actually, I think that's probably what I'm sort of doing here. So one thing to say about this idea of spiritual death, it's just like death is an end point on a journey. So actually when we talk about death, most of the time we're thinking about dying. You know, the experience of the run-up to death, because at death there's a kind of finality, it's already happened, it's like an end point. And I think with spiritual death as well, the sort of entering in, it's a process, it's an entering into it. There are moments that you can say, oh, something's changed, but they're not like, they don't have that kind of like discrete, for me anyway, they don't have the such, I don't, well, maybe it's because of the nature of my practice, I haven't had like massive aha moments or blinding enlightenments or anything like that. It's just, you know, I keep practicing and every so often I look back and I think, oh no, that's different, oh, I've changed a bit. I think, you know, there's something, it's just about being a bit more realistic, although sometimes when you look back you can actually see some of those changes can be quite radical. So our topsy-turvy views are a kind of conceptual superstructure built on top of our experience. So this idea that what we're really working with when we're practicing the Dharma is our basic experience. And this idea that we're building a conceptual superstructure on top of that that gets in the way of actually experiencing things as they are. That's a quote from Vasantara. Because they are not how things are, right? Because of our views are not how things are, they create a tension in us. You know what it's like if you have to tell a little white lie to someone and then all of a sudden you're having to invent other lies to protect the first one, and then you're in a mess. So, at least that's what happens to me, so I try not to. So the first thing that we notice when we are able to cultivate a more realistic view, right, actually sort of just being a bit more realistic, we can become more relaxed and we can be with our experience in a more natural way. I think that's one of the things that, you know, when you look back over a period, you know, have I made any progress? Well, are you a little bit more relaxed than you used to? Are you a bit more able just to be with experience? I remember about a year after I started meditating, I was going to the Glasgow Buddhist Centre. I was just noticing, oh, I'm much more happy and relaxed. but I realised was this happiness and relaxation wasn't a direct byproduct of meditation. I think that was the thing that really struck me. I realised I was a bit more relaxed, a bit more happy, but it wasn't just because I'd meditated that morning. You know, like the idea that you meditate and at the end of it you're a bit more relaxed. Yes, that happens. But it's more that after a while, you just stop doing such stupid stuff. I think that's how I described it. That's how I described it to myself. And when you stop doing quite such stupid things, you experience less tension because you're not fighting against reality so much, and you just become a bit more realistic. This is a worthy target for our practice, I think, in the short to medium term, just trying to be a bit more realistic about the way things are and our experience. So we need to be able to tell the difference between concepts and our actual direct experience. We all develop a sense of me as we're growing up, and that's necessary. We need to do that in order to survive living on this planet. And with practice, integration and positive emotion, by practicing these stages, we can develop a sense of me that is fairly happy and healthy. So although, you know, we recognize that this sense of self is a construct, it's good to have a happy, healthy, integrated sense of self. So it's still just a concept that we have taken to be real. And if we take the various elements of our experience and build concepts and build a self from them. Hang on. I think I've cut and pasted here then in the wrong way. So we're just selfing. There's this sort of term, selfing. We build these concepts. It's like, I don't know if any of you have ever been on a solitary retreat, but one of the things you really notice is the way that you talk to yourself. Or if you're on a group retreat and you're in silence, you get much stronger sense of how you talk to yourself. And I remember the first time that happened, I was on a retreat, and I was kind of going, God, I would never talk to somebody else the way that I talk to myself. It's quite humbling, actually. But in a way, that's how I was constructing my sense of myself. It was a bit. So we've had a look at the five skandhas. So if we could sort of talk about them a bit more. So they're there in the Heart Sutra. Form, feeling, thought and choice, or form, feeling, tone, hedonic tone, perception or cognition, tendencies or volitions, and consciousness. Firstly, with form, we have this concept of me, and that I have my body, and that is mine. But this form, this body, is borrowed. All of the cells that make up this body are constructed from the food, water and air that we're taking in and returning all of the time. So Kamala Shila, on a retreat I was on once, inelegantly put it like this. We have a mountain of food before us, and a mountain of poo behind us. And as we go through life, the mountain of food gets smaller and the mountain of poo gets bigger, and we sit somewhere in the middle thinking it's all me. So where does the bowl of pasta stop and become part of me? And where does it stop? Where do we decide it's no longer me? It's a little bit vivid, but I think it's a quite good illustration. It's all these cells, they're just borrowed. So feeling tone, again, is constantly changing with sensation. So if you were to just sit for a moment and tune into sensation again, feeling tone is telling you whether those sensations are pleasant, unpleasant, or somewhere in between. And even if you just stop for 10 seconds and just notice, rapidly changing sensation, rapidly changing feeling tone associated with it. Perceptions are constantly changing with our environment, with our feeling tone. So there's stuff constantly going on. I'm sitting here, I'm noticing the traffic noise, I'm noticing my own thought process, I'm noticing all sorts of visual cues. I'm looking around to see if you're falling asleep yet or not. That's good. Just like sort of cognizing. Yes, people awake, people listening, lights on, traffic, anxiety about what I'm going to say next. It's all, yes, it's all there happening, so just cognizing all of that. And then I have tendencies, you know, oh God, should I insert a joke here? Or I haven't got one. And am I, and does the panic turn to, full out anxiety? Do I have a panic attack in the middle of a talk? And actually, my tendency is to just stop. See, okay, let's calm down for a moment. So the volitions can be trained when we were going through earlier. I think that's a really good thing about, I'm really understanding the metas of volition. You know, we're actively training a tendency. These practices are habit forming. It's not just nice feelings. Feelings of Vedana, that's something else. So if you put them all together, a little bit like the horse in the field, after the class tonight, time to go home, it's probably still going to be raining, at the very least it's going to be cold and dark. So you notice this in your sensations, you notice that it's not very pleasant, you perceive rain and cold, and perhaps your habitual tendency is to wrap up, do your coat up tight, get your umbrella out, pull your hat down tight. So far so sensible, we wouldn't survive without these mechanisms. They're not wrong. What's important, we don't get rid of these skandhas, it's that we try and have like a realistic sense of what they're about and their place in our experience. So consider this, here's another one. So this is a story that a Harvard professor, Ellen Langer, talks about in one of her books. She's been researching mindfulness for decades. She's one of the early researchers, but she's not coming from the Buddhist tradition. She's a very interesting woman, but she gives very, very funny talks. She's a very funny speaker. So she was talking about, so back in the days when you paid with goods with a credit card, you had to fill in a credit card slip. You had to sign a piece of paper. So she's just got a new credit card and she'd gone to the store to buy a new toaster, I think it was. So she picked up the toaster, went to the cashier, handed over her credit card, and the cashier says, "Ah, you haven't signed your credit card, it's a new credit card, could you please sign it?" So Ellen Langer takes the credit card back, signs it, gives it to the cashier, cashier puts it through the machine, gives Ellen Langer a piece of paper to sign, Ellen Langer signs it, and the cashier does this. So slightly more seriously, so actually this is a story that Vasantra told. So it's about James Cameron, the journalist. I don't know if he does like sort of war zones and stuff like that. He was in Pakistan, and he's being shown around by some a major or a colonel in the Pakistani army, and they were quite near the Indian border. It was when there was a lot of trouble going around there. So he had this colonel with him, and he had the jeep driver, and they were on this long, dusty Pakistan road, driving towards the mountains, and way up ahead in the distance they can see a lorry's coming towards. He can see a lorry's coming towards, but he's just sitting in the jeep talking to the colonel, asking him questions, you know, what's happening with the troop, what does he think of the situation, what do you think is going to happen next, and you know, talking through all the ins and outs of troop movements and the political situation. And the driver keeps going, and the lorry keeps coming towards him. So it takes quite a long time. You know, it's a long, long road. It's not a particularly fast road. And so cut a long story short, they collide. They just have a head-on collision, right? And they've seen each other coming from like a good 5 miles away. So, and the driver was killed. The jeep driver was killed. So what killed the jeep driver? Concepts. Right? Redundant concepts. So the farmer in the lorry, he has a concept, I'm in this bloody big lorry, it's full of turnips or whatever it was, and I am the king of the roads, nobody can get, so you have to get out of my way because I'm the biggest thing here. The jeep driver has a concept of, I am the king of the road, I am in an army jeep, I am driving a colonel and a foreign journalist, we have right, and we're the most important thing on the road, so they must give way. Right? So by both people hanging on to this concept, bam. It's frightening, isn't it? You know, you just, I mean, hopefully nothing like that bad is going to happen to us, but it's kind of, this kind of way, oh, actually I need to be a bit more mindful about how I'm seeing things. So back in the Heart Sutra, it's all about what happens when we come into relationship with our direct experience. So there aren't really any skandhas. There's no senses, no organs, no eightfold path. These are all just concepts. They're not there in the sense that they're actually concepts. They're not the actual experience. No eightfold path, all concepts. Most of the time we confuse concepts with experience. Concepts are useful, but we need to know that they are concepts. So there's a little so can't help quoting the Bahia Sutta here. So this is this guy Bahia. He was an ascetic who thought that he'd really got somewhere, and then this deva appears to him in a dream and says, oh no, you haven't, you need to go and find a better teacher. So he walks hundreds of miles across India to go and see the Buddha, and then the Buddha's on his arms around, and the Buddha usually doesn't speak to anybody on his arms around, but Bahia is very persuasive, so the Buddha just lets him have this very pithy teaching, and he says, then Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the scene, there will be only the scene. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. When for you there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then Bahia, there is no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of stress. So really what he's doing is just kind of throwing Bahia right back onto his direct experience. It's like, just let go of all these concepts. Then it's possible that this list of ways that the Buddha is explaining how to be in contact with his, maybe it has some reference to the way Bahia was practicing before he'd met the Buddha, we don't know. All that we have is this, all we have recorded is this little encounter. Every time we come back to direct experience in the way that the Buddha outlines to Bahia, we open to spiritual death. Right? Every time we just come back to our basic experience, we have the possibility that we can just soften the edges of our concept, our holding on to our concepts. It's another little story. I've been a vegetarian for 33 years now, and I've always liked Chinese food, both to cook and eat. And quite early on, I discovered oyster sauce. So oyster sauce is used in a lot of Chinese recipes, but because I was vegetarian, I wouldn't use it. It's a bit frustrating because I wanted the authentic taste. So one day, many years later, I had an argument with a Chinese friend of mine who was insistent that I could eat the oyster sauce. And I don't know if you've had East Asian friends, you've ever had conversations with them about vegetarianism. It gets a bit weird to say, oh, do you eat onions and garlic? Yes. Well, you're not vegetarian then. What? But you can eat shellfish. What? Anyway, so I thought it was one of those conversations, and it went on for a while, and I just thought they hadn't really understood what being vegetarian meant. So she was so insistent that next time I was in the Chinese supermarket, I picked up a bottle of oyster sauce. Guess what? No oysters. There are no oysters in oyster sauce. I recommend you check the ingredients of any particular bottle that you might pick up if you're suddenly keen to go out and buy oyster sauce. But I just thought that's quite interesting. You know, in life we just keep looking for or avoiding the oysters. They've always been there, and it's even called oyster sauce, but there are no oysters. The same could be said of the ego, the self. We think there's a me. If we have a sense of a permanent me in here, comparing praise, blame, pleasure, pain, existence, non-existence, there is just no self. If there is just no self, then we can just let the whole lot go. Easier said than done. We could perhaps just begin to open to a slightly different world, a slightly freer world, a world in which we are no longer avoiding fake oysters. How are you doing? Okay? I'll just keep going. Okay. So one of the other things that Subhuti was mentioning in that little passage I read out was the lakshanas. A lakshana is a mark of conditioned existence. It's like you can recognize what conditioned existence, because it has these three marks, and that's it's impermanent, it's insubstantial, and it is not satisfying, not ultimately satisfying. The key to working with these, and in a way reflecting on the lakshanas, is probably a good way just to begin to become a bit more realistic, just noticing them in our experience. So I've got another quote here, this time from Rob Berbier's Seeing That Frees. And this is speaking to recognizing elements of a fixed self, and there's some ways that we do this. And there's also the sense of, like, as soon as you've done that, there's that opening to spiritual rebirth. He says, I might begin to notice that a certain way I unkindly defined myself or my personality, perhaps for decades, is simply not a fixed truth of who I am. Seeing this early, I let go of the tight binding of the particular self-view and begin to feel a degree of freedom, released from the familiar but painful confines of that particular prison. And although it's possible that this newfound freedom feels a little disorientating for a while, I soon get used to it and enjoy the novel sense of spaciousness. So a sense like, if we're investing in our practice and trying to become a bit more realistic, that we don't, it's not like we're trying to give something up. It's actually the carrot, if you like, it's not a stick approach, it's a carrot approach. The carrot is a sense of more openness, more freedom, just letting life run a bit more naturally, not having to fight against things. I can recognize myself in some of that in the past. So he describes the conceptualizing of experience that concretizes into a sense of me and mine, this process of selfing. Perhaps you noticed when you were new to Buddhism, before we learnt how to assimilate the customs of the Buddhist tribe into our self-sense, as Maitreya Bandhu puts it, it all feels a bit alien, and those weird names, and you never get used to them, or maybe you do, I don't know, I shouldn't make assumptions, but now, pretty much, you're all comfortable here. I'm making another assumption. Perhaps you come regularly to the center, perhaps this class, perhaps you call yourself a Buddhist. Perhaps being a Buddhist becomes so important to you that it's completely changed your life. Our sense of self can change for the better. It's like one day I noticed I was calling myself a Buddhist, and had a particular view that came with it, and what I thought that was, and that was me. And I decided I'm that sort of person, I'm a Buddhist person, and this is who I am, and this is what I do. But you can find that, you know, it's co-opted into this fixed sense of self, holding against change and holding against the world. When I recently just started to take my practice seriously and moved into a community in the East End with four other guys who were, you know, getting quite committed to their practice, there seemed to be this, we seemed to get door-to-door Christians on the doorstep, quite a lot, particularly the Jehovah's Witnesses. And I would find myself trying to have a discussion with them, and then I'd find myself getting quite angry and heated. And it was really annoying, because I realised what I was doing was I was holding my views just as hard as they were, you know. It's humbling, and it bothered me a good deal. I didn't want to do blind belief, and I didn't want to hold my views that tightly, but right there and then, that is exactly what I was doing. I suppose the fact that it bothered me is a good sign, and that, yeah, I think I've sort of softened out a bit. Hopefully I've softened out a bit since then. So that's the sense of self. So impermanence, the second of the lakshanas, perhaps one of the key concepts that Buddhism is known by. And I'm sure we all understand what that means by now, and have tried to come into relationship with as part of our practice, even in some small way. We don't look the same as we did. That much we can reflect on. We don't do the same things. We don't think the same way. That's quite an interesting exercise, actually, just to cast your mind back 10 years and just think about the way that you were thinking about the world 10 years ago. And it's a good chunk of time. One's view on life can change quite a lot in 10 years. So when we reflect, it's good to take time just to take in how much we have changed, hopefully for the better. And also, in that reflecting, we can also know it's a good place just to notice how we have made progress, how we have changed. Yeah. So coming into relationship with dukkha, so this word dukkha means unsatisfactoriness, usually translated as suffering, but unsatisfactoriness is probably more to the point. It comes from the root word meaning a badly fitting cartwheel. So you can imagine on the dusty roads of India, a badly fitting cartwheel, it's just uncomfortable all of the time. Yeah, it's not bad, it's not the cart has fallen apart, it just doesn't quite work. And actually it's quite a good word for our experience, I think, sometimes. Most of the time we avoid it until it forces its way into our consciousness. But it's just going on, it's always there, it's always available for us to work with. Just as impermanence and insubstantiality, we can tune into, we can also tune into dukkha. Because things are impermanent, because things are insubstantial, you know, that's a cause for suffering, you know. The suffering that things might end soon, or that they have, you know, or you're trying to keep them the same. You want the good things to continue, you want the bad things at bay. So some change you want, some change you don't want. And it just kind of puts you into that polarized thing of like wanting this, not wanting that, wanting this, not wanting that. If we can just kind of get past the wanting and not wanting, and just kind of slow down for a bit, and just go, oh, actually, I'm just a little bit uncomfortable somewhere, you know, and maybe you can start to identify what that's about, and just have the experience. I remember when I first started teaching for professional dancers back, you know, some years ago. It was when I kind of intensified my practice. I was on the ordination process at the time, and as part of the intensification of that process, I was going like to work every morning off to teach, and just feeling a bit anxious, like a bit uncomfortable, not like panicky, but just a bit there. Ugh. And I sort of realised, you know, I could quite easily compensate against that. I could, you know, put my Walkman on, buy a paper, sit on the tube and just not notice it. But I started to realise there was something really satisfying about just having the experience that was there. Like, it was more relaxing just to have that slightly unpleasant experience than it was to kind of push it away. And you think, oh, I don't want that. It'll be much more relaxing if I put my Walkman on and buy a paper and or read my book. And I can just relax my way on. Actually, it was more relaxing, more satisfying, just to have the uncomfortable experience. I mean, some uncomfortable experiences are actually warning signs, and it's good to listen to them. This was just a bit of an existential grunge, and in a way, existential grunge is just grist for the mill, really. You know, it can be good fuel for our practice if we can let it be so. Another way into working with dukkha is to recognize that the ego, the self, the fixed self, the conceptualized self, the unreconstructed conceptualized self, I should say, thrives on melodrama. These powerful emotions can give us a strong sense of self, but they often just create more suffering. Sometimes we create the big and dramatic just to reassure ourselves that we are still here. There is a me in here versus the world out there going on, but this is just another concept. It arises out of a sense of being existentially alone, perhaps. But this is not how things are. We're intimately connected all of the time. When these melodramas operate on a national scale, we get war. You see it going on all the time. Al-Qaeda beheaded a bunch of people, Saudi Arabia beheaded a bunch of people. And it's just like somebody's just trying to push some buttons. That's how it looks to me. I don't know what the situation, but it's just like they're just trying to get. It's like, well, particularly with this so-called ISIS group, it's like they're really just trying to get a reaction. They're really just trying to prod us in the ribs, and some of the newspapers are really responding to that. They're really having a big melodrama about it. They're really describing our national self to us. And then a lot of us are going, no, that's not me. That's not my sense of self. That's not the nation that I want to be part of. You know, so I don't quite know what we do about that. Become rich and buy out a newspaper. That's the thing to do. That's my advice to you. I'm going to keep going, actually, so we'll have the tea break a bit later. So there's a list of things here. Practices to encourage spiritual death, and they're very simple things. Some of these I got from Maitreya Bandhu when he was giving his talk here, but then I've been thinking about this quite a bit. I really enjoyed this little list that he started, like things like generosity was one of the things he said, confession, apology, forgiveness, gratitude. Really nice little list, just these things that can kind of sort of just wear down the fixity. It's, you know, we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's like, you know, that happy, healthy sense of self that kind of keeps us sane. But at the same time, we can just kind of soften the edges. We don't throw it out all at once. We just kind of wear it down gradually. Each time we wear it down a bit, we see how it feels, we adjust, we get used to the disorientation. Maybe we like it, maybe we don't. Maybe it brings up other things. We work through those other things, and then we can go a little bit further. Another thing that Maitreya Bandhu talks about in his book is rapturous aesthetic experience, which I really like. Like, you know, if you like going to music concerts, or my thing is dance or theatre. Or even just sometimes with my iPod on, like some of the music, like sitting on the bus having this kind of rapturous experience. That's well worth having, or just like a moment in nature. You know, just Rachel was telling us about the being on retreat last week and looking at the stars and the moon and just how beautiful it all was. That's another moment of just kind of just becoming a bit more realistic, just kind of opening to something that's a bit bigger. So there's beauty and there's also the sublime. So the beautiful starry sky, but also the sublime in thunderstorms, the sort of, you know, everything that nature can kind of throw at you. Communication exercises. Has anybody here not done communication exercises? A few, one or two. Okay. We'll have to bring them back. They're, yeah. These days it's a good way to empty a Buddhist centre if you announce that you're going to do communication exercises, but...
And the
multiple choice question tests, yes. But they're really, really good exercises to do. They're really, really good. I don't think we'll have time this evening. But maybe. Maybe we'll do a little bit. Reflecting. Reflection. Taking on a daily reflection... A daily reflection practice is a really good way. Noticing, reflecting on and noticing how we conceptualize our experience. Just trying to catch ourselves at it, as it were. Reflecting on and noticing the lakshanas in our experience. Just noticing things changing. Noticing that the way we conceptualize ourselves isn't quite how things really are. Trying to be a bit more realistic. Allowing us to have just the experience that's happening, even if it's a bit unpleasant. This idea, nothing special. Awareness that there's nothing special about meditation, we're just sitting here. It's a good place to start. It's just very ordinary, natural being with our experience, just as it is. Good place to start reflection from. This kind of being with and letting be often produces feelings of boredom. That's a really good sign. just allowing things to just get a little bit boring, right? Not really doing anything. It can open this liminal space where things can just go a little bit deeper. It's like the sort of boredom can be a portal into deeper experience if we let it be. It can take some work to get used to that sort of subtle way of working, but it should definitely be available to anybody who's got a reasonably regular meditation practice. Spiritual death can sometimes cause people to brace themselves because of the word death, when what is actually needed is just to let it be, just letting things be. Part of the reason that Sangharaja started using this terminology is actually that quite radical transformations do take place through the spiritual death process. Further down the line, I mean, you know, it's quite, on the one hand, it's quite, we want a path of regular steps, we want a gradual process, we don't want to gate crash the transcendental. We just want to work on it bit by bit, but sometimes, you know, you sort of have these realized, sometimes they're rigid, that things do just open up, and you can have these quite radical experiences, things just are going to be different, just because you've seen things a bit more fully, a bit more realistically. this is a quote from Vasantara. There's no self now. There isn't any self now. We don't lose anything real. We just lose a painful, limiting delusion. We have nothing to lose but our chains, what Blake called our mind-forged manacles. In that sense, like, people fear annihilation. I'm going to wipe them. I'm not going to have a self anymore. No. But you don't have a self in the first place, so don't worry. Here's another perspective from Bhante. Instead of being unattached to anything, right, seeing everything as empty and not attached to it, he says, you could try being attached to absolutely everything. He said that would work just as well. I'm not quite sure how you do that, but... I think it's quite an interesting perspective. Spiritual death, so it's giving up selfing is like giving up smoking. You start off with 100 a day habit and you cut down and eventually you stop. Spiritual death can often bring about feelings of disorientation but also freedom. But they lead to freedom. There is often a fear of annihilation, fear of losing the self when we never had one in the first place. We're not seeking to annihilate the self, we are seeking to realize something that has been true all along, and in seeing that we are freer. Uh, That's another thread I wanted to just kind of mention, is this idea of initiation. It's very quite so in the Triratna order, spiritual death and spiritual rebirth is very, you know, it's kind of, the ordination very strongly enacts that, the sort of moment of initiation. In many cultures, the idea of initiation is a spiritual death moment. Some, and many traditional cultures would enact, the initiation would enact, simulate an actual physical death. There'd be beatings, there'd be cuts, there'd be near-death experiences kind of laid on for the initiate. Thank you. Thank you very much. So round about the time we're about to be ordained, before the initiation happens, we usually try and go through a period of doing explicit Vipassana practice. We do the six element practice. We're sort of deliberately deconstructing the self. Those practices are kind of reserved for that stage and beyond. It's, Sangha actually says there's no point in doing those kind of practices without like a really effective going for issues, to the point of being ready for ordination. It only really makes sense if enlightenment is what you really want. If you really want to awaken, it's the only reason for doing those kind of, for those much, much stronger practices. So there's a period of doing the, and then on my own ordination retreat, we had 2 weeks where we're doing the six element practice every day in silence. The whole retreat was in silence. We'd already been on retreat for 7 or 8 weeks, 6 or 7 weeks, and then we went to this period of spiritual death. And we particularly didn't call each other by our names. At the end of that period, we were all supposed to. Actually, no, I'm not going to. That's a spoiler. In case any of you were to ever go on the ordination course, I'm not going to tell you what happens next. But eventually, you get ordained. That's what happens. And you have a private ordination with your preceptor, and that represents the idea that, even if nobody else is working for awakening, I'm going to do it regardless. So it's, you know, it's a private thing. I'm going to do it, whatever. And from that point until the public ordination, a week or so later, so part of the initiation, the private ordination, is you're given your new name, but nobody else knows it. It's not announced until the public ordination. So there's this period. We weren't in silence anymore, but we made an undertaking with each other not to use our names, which was, yeah, it was very funny actually. And then there's this moment where you have the public ordination, you're welcomed into the order and your name is announced, and so there's that sort of sense of like going into the spiritual death and being in that place where you don't even have a name. You don't, like, that sense of self is, you know, it just sort of reinforces that sense of, you're kind of softening that sense of self, that you're not reinforcing it by having a name or a sense, you know, all of the usual cues that tell you that you are you. Every time somebody that calls you your name, it's like, oh yeah, that's me. But if nobody's calling your name, that sense of me, it does actually, I kind of felt that, you know, quite strongly through that period. It does kind of feel like you're less firmly fixed. But also at the same time, you have a fuller sense of experience because of that. It's a very interesting experience. Anyway, another way of noting, working with the idea of spiritual death, is to notice all the things that you haven't fulfilled over the last year. You could set aside an evening once a year, like perhaps New Year is a good time before you make your New Resolution. Well, it's a bit too late now, but. Well, it's never too late. I mean, you could just pick a day and you just kind of go through the year and like, well, what have I left undone? What was I going to do that I haven't done? What remains unfulfilled? That sort of breakdowns the year, because all those things that you wanted to do, oh yeah, I could do that. I could do this. I really want this to happen. Then you didn't do them. It's like, oh, well, I'm not that person. challenges that, oh, I'm not that person. Robert Bly talks about, I remember in one of his books he talks about, one particular tradition, I can't remember which it was, but the idea of going on like a solitary retreat. And the purpose of the retreat is to grieve everything that you haven't done in the previous year. I really like that idea, that you just like catch up with the unmet aspirations, and that is a challenge to the sense of self. That's one of the reasons why I go on solitary retreat every year, that sense of like, really, well, where am I in my practice? I'm not going to talk about bereavement, you can figure that out for yourselves. There's some other tips here. How are we doing for time? Okay, so we're on to the here's a couple of sample questions to give you a taste for how to work with the multiple choice test. With a bit of guessing you might get through anyway, but here's question 17, and it's about Shakyamuni, the Buddha, and his experience after gaining enlightenment, sitting under the Bodhi tree by the Naranjana River, having just realized the truth of things, including no self and lack of inherent existence in all phenomena. At that point, did he A. think to himself, bugger, shucks, I've gained enlightenment and now I don't exist. Why did I do it? What do I do now? Or did he, B, sit with that realization, blissful for several weeks, sitting under different trees in that area, and then he got up, preserving his body for another 45 odd years, being immensely compassionate and immensely caring, teach with such energy that he established a path that has been passed on for 2,500 years.